This episode of 3GT is brought to you by Wipfenstock Publishers, who has recently published C.J. Williams' book, The Shadow of Christ in Job. For your chance to win one of three copies, head on over to gentlereformation.com and leave a comment under the post for this episode. Again, thanks to our sponsor, Wipfenstock Publishers.
Welcome to 3GT, a podcast where a pastor, parishioner, and professor have lively conversations on practical Christian living from a Reformed perspective. For more information, visit our website at 3GT.fm.
Welcome to another episode of 3GT. I'm here today with Kyle Borg and Aaron Sams, and this is Barry York. And I'm sitting in the beautiful Rare Books Room of the Reformed Presbyterian Seminary with my good friend and colleague, Dr. C.J. Williams. Greetings, C.J.
Greetings. Good to be with you.
Yeah, glad to have you here. Thanks. We're interviewing C.J. today with respect to a new book that he's just had published, The Shadow of Christ and the Book of Job. And this is a book that C.J.'s been working on for some time. He actually was working on a longer commentary and then decided to break away from that and put together a smaller work on that to make this book more accessible to lay people. And so we just wanted to chat with you a bit about your book, C.J. And again, why Job? Why did you choose Job? And what about this title, The Shadow of Christ in the Book of Job? What's your name?
Well, first of all, thanks for talking to me and having me on the podcast today. Why Job? I'm going to start with that question. I guess that's a good question. I have preached and taught through Job several times, and the book just always stuck with me. Just fascinated me in so many ways. I never felt like I had the best handle on it, so I kept studying it, and it just sort of stayed with me. And so it's always been an attraction to me, a draw to me. I began that commentary that you mentioned a moment ago, and I felt like the more I understood the book and the more I felt like I had a grasp on its meaning as a whole, I thought, well, I'll start with that. I'll start with a smaller work that tries to simply give a bird's eye view of the book and how to understand it in its place in the Old Testament. And so that's what the book's about. The title, I think, contains the thesis. You know, it really is an attempt to look at the book of Job and understand it through the lens of the work of Christ. And I think when you do that, the book really opens up. Its power and its place in the canon really just shine through.
Hmm. Yeah, I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about that. You start off the book with a chapter on topology, and I think that's an important subject to consider. Could you explain a little bit your approach to topology and how, with a book like Job, where perhaps Christ-like themes might not just jump out at everyone, how do you avoid things such as allegorization and that type of approach?
Great question. And I wanted to begin the book with just a brief description of typology and what it is, precisely because of some of the abuses of the past, of typology being kind of falling into disrepute and people misusing it and typologizing, using typology sort of as a tool. So I begin the book with a chapter that describes typology as an exegetical discipline, something that has to be textually controlled. And so I describe that as succinctly as I can and try to describe what typology is. And basically, I define it as God's method of using people and events and institutions in history to foreshadow the fulfillment of gospel realities. His promises and provisions in the covenant of grace being depicted on the stage of history really bring his promises to life and really bring them down to touch down on the experience of the people in such a way that offers them hope and assurance. So they're not just hanging on to a word of prophecy or something in a literary sense, but God illustrates his promises to them like historical living sermon illustrations, if you will, you know, to assure mm-hmm. them of the promise, primarily that Christ is coming, that the Redeemer that he promised is coming. And so they were assured of that through typology. And it's a blessing to us as well. We see these different pictures of Christ depicted on the stage of ancient history that really accentuate certain things about his person and work. The book of Job accentuates the fact that he suffered grievously, and suffering was part of his work of salvation, not just his death on the cross, but the suffering that he endured for our sakes, because that's what sin deserves. Not only is the wages of sin death, but also that grievous suffering is something that every sin deserves in this life and the next. And the depiction of Job's suffering reflects what Christ endured on our behalf, and what Job got a sort of typological prophetic foretaste of in his experience.
Mm-hmm. Hey, CJ, one of the things that I do on our show here is ask all the questions that our listeners are probably asking at this point, because I'm the one without any formal seminary training. But could you give us a distinction between typology and allegory? Just kind of a quick summary of what the difference is, just in case people don't know.
Yeah, like me. A great question, Aaron. And the difference between the two is allegory, that allegorical method of interpreting something, comes from the philosophical school of Plato from Greece. And it is a way of viewing a text in a non-historical perspective. In other words, allegorization looks at a text not as a historical reality, but as a extended metaphor of a spiritual point, of some kind of spiritual lesson. So to allegorize, say, David and Goliath, or whatever story you want to choose from biblical history, it doesn't have to be real history. You can say David represents this and Goliath represents that, and it's all sort of an extended metaphor of some spiritual truth, not necessarily rooted in history and no reality to it. Whereas typology is founded upon real history, real people, real events, real institutions that are invested by God with a prophetic purpose. In other words, they become like a prophecy that is, they embody a prophecy and just reflect it in whatever way God appoints them to, historically speaking. So allegory, no root in history. Typology is all about history.
Got it. Thank you. That's very helpful.
Yeah.
So with that, then you would be stating that Job was a true historical figure. Of course, there are commentaries that would see this more like a play, an ancient play, where you have this man suffering and these friends coming, and you'd be learning spiritual truths about human suffering or those types of things. But one of the things that you really point out in your book is what you call the messianic trajectory and how Job fits into that. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. To your earlier point about the historicity of Job, that's not really in vogue to believe that anymore.
Right.
Very few people do. But I would just say that the rest of the Bible affirms Job as a real character, a real example of patience joined to faith. Book of James mentions him. The book of Ezekiel mentions him.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not referenced as sort of some mythological or fictional character. Now, you had mentioned, yes, the messianic trajectory. That's the name of one of the chapters of the book. And what I try to do in that chapter is just look for historical patterns that are intended to be prophetic or typological. You look at Christ's life. He's mentioned a few times that his life is characterized, his work and his ministry is characterized by the experience of suffering leading to glory. And Peter mentioned that all the prophets testify to that, to the sufferings of Christ and the glory that will follow. So that's the pattern of prophecy that we see. And so many of the literary prophecies, think of the Psalms, think of the servant songs of Isaiah, how it's always suffering leading to glory. And that really is the story of Christ's life and ministry. So that's in the realm of literary prophecy, and we see that come to pass in the Gospels. But if you look in the realm of history, which is the realm of typology, you can see several prominent figures in the Bible whose life is characterized by that experience of undeserved suffering leading to glory, or beginning in a certain established position, but being cast down from that position, undeservedly, unjustly persecuted, and then being raised up again by the hand of God to an even more exalted place than at the beginning. You think of Joseph. The story of Joseph is one of the longest, most elaborate in Old Testament. It's built on that pattern of experience. Think of the life of David. It's built on that pattern of experience too, of suffering leading to glory. And all the Psalms that David wrote, basically all of them contain something of that pattern of tribulation leading to grace and so on. So that's what I mean by the trajectory of messianic experience, that being established, being cast down undeservedly, persecuted unjustly, and then being raised up again by the hand of God. And nowhere is that pattern more clear than in the book of Job, I think. Job, we're introduced to him as the greatest, most pious man on the earth. God brags about him. There's no one on the earth like him. Suddenly, he's cast down to the depths of more suffering than any man had ever deserved, we won't talk about deserved, right? We'll talk about any man had ever experienced,
right?
The depths of suffering. And then finally, at the end of the book, we're told that God restored Job and gave him twice as much as he had in the beginning. And it says that the latter years of Job were more glorious than the beginning. And if in the beginning he was the greatest man on the earth, none like him on earth, then his latter years must have been, indescribable. So his experience is built on that pattern.
Mm-hmm. One of the fascinating things that you've mentioned, both in the book as well as I've heard you talk about this, is the historical placement of Job, where he comes, where this book comes really in the timing of the canon, and how he sets a precedent in this book. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Oh, okay. Well, there's a lot of different views on the date of the book, and if Job was a historical figure, when might he have lived? I think modern scholarship tends to see it as a much later book, maybe right around the Babylonian exile, maybe right after it, right around that point. I think the setting of events in the book align well with the patriarchal period. If you think of Job's faith as it's described in chapter 1 especially, he just makes sacrifices like Abraham did without any real reference to the law of Moses or the institutions of Israel. So it's probably a very early book, and Job is probably a patriarchal figure, in our estimation, in my estimation. But I think Calvin said it best when he said, well, we don't know how old it is, we just know it's ancient. And so that's probably the best you can say, and we probably leave it at that. But nevertheless,
I think my students have a similar view of me when I was a teacher. They didn't know how old I was. I was just ancient. So.
Just ancient.
Well, at least they didn't cut you in half and count your rings, right?
Maybe. This is true. Yeah. We have tools for that now.
But I think it's significant if we can date Job early on in the patriarchal period, which I think we can. I think it's a reasonable conclusion. We don't have to insist on it, but I think it's a reasonable conclusion. Then it kind of casts a different light on Job, that Job, the story of Job, is one of maybe the earlier depictions of this sort of vicarious suffering, this prophetic suffering that would lead to Christ. And maybe Job is the man and the book that begins this theme in Scripture that we see developed also again much later in the Psalms and in the servant songs of Isaiah and other places too, where we get this increasingly clearer picture of this suffering Savior. But the picture might begin with Job.
Mm-hmm. How did the, Satan plays a prominent part in the book of Job, as he also has these antagonist friends, in quotes, that come to supposedly console with them. How do they factor into this whole idea? If you look at Job as a typological figure, where does Satan and these antagonists come in?
That's a great question. I think Satan's role in this book, as he comes into the presence of God, surprisingly to the reader, to see him come and present himself among the other angelic beings, God calls him to account and says, from where have you come? And Satan, in response, brags of his liberty to walk around the earth and, by implication, spread his influence. He says, I've been walking on the earth and going to and fro in it. Mm-hmm. That sets up the whole story of Job. God calls Satan to account. Satan brags about his autonomy and his liberty. And in response to that, God says, abruptly, seemingly out of nowhere, have you considered my servant Job? And it's my perspective that Job is now seen as God's answer to Satan. He is the answer to the wandering adversary of the world, and who tries to hold the world under his sway. And God's answer will come in the form of a man who is great, exalted, but will be cast down and suffer and humiliated, and then will be exalted again at last. And this experience exactly mirrors the ultimate answer of God to Satan in Christ, who, we are told in Philippians, was equal with God and then became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. And then God highly exalted him, gave him the name which is above every other name. So it's this image of a righteous sufferer enduring that faithfully and then being exalted by the hand of God. That is God's answer to Satan, provisionally in Job and ultimately in Christ.
And where do the antagonists come in? His friends that come
in. Oh, his friends?
Yeah.
Yeah, his friends are, they're comic relief, I think. Yeah.
that's my job here, too.
No, that's it. There's Eliphaz and Bildad there on the podcast over there.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that part of that picture of messianic suffering is to be wrongly accused of being a sinner, right? And that was said of Christ, exactly. He was numbered among the transgressors. And that was part of his affliction. Even though he was innocent, he suffered like a sinner. And so everyone around him thought he was a sinner. When he's hanging on the cross, everyone thought he deserved it. This man must be a sinner because righteous men don't get crucified. And so that was part of the affliction that he had to bear, to be judged, to be numbered among the transgressors. And that's exactly what Job's friends do. Job is innocent. God said Job is innocent. At the beginning of the book, he's blameless and upright. But here these three friends come along and they are accusing him of sin. And they, in a sense, contribute, maybe unwittingly, to the typological image in Job because they numbered him among the transgressors, even though he was blameless and upright. So I think that's the role that they play.
CJ, in the history of Christian theology, has the position you're arguing that Job is typology for Christ, is that been pretty much consensus throughout the history of theology, and then just the more modern interpretations of Job or using it allegorically, I guess the question I'm asking is, how has the book of Job been treated throughout church history? Has it always been viewed in this way?
It's a great question. It's a huge question, but a good one, an important one. I have a very short chapter in the book about that, just, you know, 10 pages or so, that tries to overview the history of commentary on Job. And it's hard to do justice to it in a small chapter. But I would say, just generally speaking, the church fathers are not hesitant to talk about Job as a type of Christ, especially Gregory the Great. He has a wonderful commentary on Job. He does delve into allegory. You know, that's part of the methodology of the time that some church fathers resorted to. So they certainly do that, but they do see Job as this Christ figure. They do look at them that way, but allegorically, most of all. I think when you get to the Middle Ages, the trend is still the same. There's more of an emphasis on moral gleanings from Job and such things as that. You get to the Reformation, there's not a whole lot of treatment on Job. Theodore Beza did write a commentary on Job, but Luther and Calvin did not. Calvin preached a bunch of series through Job, but never included that in his commentaries. And I would say, really, there's no real talk of typology in Job among those reformers. That's really not a major part of their perspective. Modern commentary tends to go in a lot of different directions. A lot of modern commentary goes after higher critical themes and, you know, date and authorship and things like that. And commentary today from the evangelical world, the Reformed world, tends to focus on Job as being a book about the problem of human suffering and God's answer to it, the problem of evil in the world and things like that. But I would say my perspective on the book is not, certainly not unheard of. There are other people who see typology in Job, but it's not the predominant view of the book. at least, you know, not in recent commentary anyway, not in modern commentaries. That's not a predominant view. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have in this book, it's a, you know, it's a shorter work, but it's still very significant. I've really enjoyed reading it. And
which, by the way, if I can interrupt you for a minute, Barry,
yeah,
I'm sitting here staring at my 12 volumes of Joseph Carroll's Practical Observations on Job. And as much as my heart sings for Puritans, thank you, CJ, for writing an accommodating book.
Yeah, that is a monumental work, those 12 volumes by Carroll. And I have spent long hours digging through that and reading it. There's a lot of value in that work. But yeah, but by contrast, my tiny little book, you know, it's funny to compare. But that was the point. I wanted to write something succinct and something that, you know, a person could read in, say, two sittings or whatever, and just have an overview of the book and just try to understand its purpose, its place in the canon. And hopefully in the future, God willing, I'd like to write in a little more detail about the Book of Job, maybe a commentary, but I doubt I'll produce 12 volumes.
Well, he spent a couple decades preaching through it, from my understanding, to get there.
Speaking of accessibility, CJ, who's your intended audience for this book? Is this something more for pastors, theologian types, or is this written for lay folk like myself? Or who do you think would benefit most from it?
Yeah, I tried to make it accessible to a broader range of people. I'm hoping the pastors will find some benefit from it, but hopefully my intention was to make it readable and accessible to just about anybody who has an interest in the Book of Job. So I'm hoping I hit that mark. I don't know if I did, but that was the intention.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, in writing it and hitting the different touch points where you see the topology of Job picturing Christ, what would be one of your highlights, one of the chapters that you really enjoyed the most writing, or the thing that you've enjoyed most seeing?
Hmm. Well, I would have to say it's hard to pick a highlight, but because, I mean, I enjoyed writing the whole book.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's hopefully there's a lot of benefit in it, hopefully. But I think it was really neat. There's a chapter in the book about royal and priestly imagery. And I thought it was neat. Once I sort of became aware of that theme and sort of got on it and started thinking about it and reading and rereading the book from that perspective, it's really fascinating how Job will depict himself on one hand like a king who has lost his crown,
mm-hmm.
or on the other hand, he's depicted in a priestly role in mediating mm-hmm. between God and man, whether it's offering sacrifice for his children or praying on behalf of his friends at the end of the book, and other instances too,
mm-hmm.
where there's this picture of him as a royal priest, a king, and a mediator, and that just comes through in the book. And that was sort of the two features of Melchizedek in his appearance too, you know, as a type of Christ without a genealogy like Job, mm-hmm. and so on. You know, so there are a lot of those kind of similarities too, and to see those similarities, say, between Job and other figures whom we know are types of Christ, like Adam in his representative capacity and Melchizedek in his mm-hmm, mediatorial mm-hmm. role and other things like that, then, you know, it was really fascinating to see. And as that developed and opened up, it was just, the book became more and more exciting for me to write.
Yeah, I really appreciated seeing that. I'd never noticed that before, that connection. And that kind of leads to a question of, you know, biblical interpretation. So with respect to Melchizedek, we get a lot of help in the New Testament in the book of Hebrews as that topology is developed. Would you say that we can take a treatment like that of an Old Testament figure and then do likewise with someone who's not mentioned so extensively in the New Testament, such as Job? Is that a proper hermeneutical jump to make?
Well, that is a great question. And I don't think everyone's settled on that, whether or not we can sort of step beyond that circle of types that the New Testament recognizes and say that there's more typological content to the Old Testament than the New Testament acknowledges. I think that is the case. I don't think New Testament commentary or the types that they point out necessarily exhaust Old Testament typology. So I I'm among those who believe the prospect remains open, but we should follow those patterns that we see. What constitutes a type, and how does the New Testament identify them? And Melchizedek's a great example. You know, you look at that and you think, well, okay, there's really not much about him. But think about Melchizedek. He appears on the scene out of nowhere. He's a priest and a king. He stands between Abram and God and pronounces a blessing on God and Abram. Mm-hmm. He's greater than Abraham and is a mediator between God and man. If he stands between them and blesses them both, mm-hmm. and then he receives a tithe from Abraham, which is an act of worship. Mm-hmm. So even though he's there for only a few verses, just everything about him just screams typology. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so there are some features about Job that he shares with Melchizedek. He appears with no recorded genealogy. He also appears in that mediatorial role, and that he's depicted in a kingly perspective too, and one who suffers grievously. So a king and a priest who suffers and then is exalted, you know, mm-hmm. that's the image that emerges. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just, it really gives us a important mm-hmm. perspective on mm-hmm. reading Job's story.
And some slight association we'd have to be careful of, perhaps, interpreting something like that. But when you have such a key figure and the touch points are so repeated, as you bring out in your book, it becomes overwhelming, really very convincing, I think, of just the way that Job is picturing Christ for us in these different capacities, and this kingly priest is certainly one of them.
Can I ask a question? Is that all right, Barry?
Sure.
All right. I appreciate that.
I was waiting for you to pipe in.
So, CJ, I hope that I'm trying to frame this in a way that it's not at all insulting. I'm trying to set you up for a good answer, I hope. So sometimes when you read books or studies where they look for Jesus in the Old Testament, the way that authors, the way that theologians or exegetes get there is really wonderful. And I think in and of itself is very practical for Christians. 2 Corinthians 4, we need to see the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ in all things. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it seems to me that it can at times seem like a 747 taking off, where it's really impressive to see, but it never really touches down in people's lives. So I guess I'm just wondering, and I think you've probably alluded to some of this in what you've said, but just very simply spell it out clearly. Where do you hope this book will really touch down in the lives of people? You want it for a broad audience, from the stay-at-home mom to the busy blue-collar worker and so forth. What would your hope be that this really communicates to their practical everyday living?
That is a great question, and thank you for it. The last chapter of the book, I try to pull that together, and the last chapter is called What the Book of Job Means Today. And I'm basing the typology of Job in no small part on this pattern of suffering leading to glory. And that was Job's experience as a type of Christ. That was Christ's experience as our Savior. And so he is the one, Christ is the one, who pioneered this pathway of suffering leading to glory. And so much of the New Testament passages that deal with, you know, the purpose of tribulation in our lives, mm-hmm. see it in relation to our union with him in this experience. If we suffer with him and in him, we'll also be glorified in him. And so one of the points I make is that, like Job, we never suffer outside of Christ. Any tribulation that we face in life is, to the Christian, a testimony that we are united to him. And that the experience that we have now is a testimony to the glory that will follow. And so we are to see it that way. And Paul tells us to glory in our tribulations. And James says to count it all joy, those kind of things. Now, that's hard for us to grasp, I think, sometimes whenever we're in the midst of suffering. But I think we're able to grasp that if we can only see ourselves united to Christ by faith, and recognizing that it is those hard experiences of life, of tribulation, are a testimony to us in the faith that we are united to him and will be glorified with him. So that's the point that I I hope to bring out, and I try to bring out at the in the last chapter of the book, which was a great comfort to me to think about and to write about. Hopefully that's going to be the practical fruit of this study.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yeah. Well, thank you, CJ. I think that's a great place to just end this. And we really appreciate you joining us here at 3GT. We want to let our readers know, if you'll continue to listen, that Whip and Stock, who are carrying this book, published this book, are offering some copies, free copies, to our listeners. So if you'll continue to listen, you'll find out how you might win a free copy of Dr. Williams' book. And if you don't get the free copy, I'd encourage you to head over to Amazon or other places where this book is sold and get it. I think you'll be greatly enriched in your reading and understanding of the Book of Job. Also, Dr. Williams, just yesterday before this recording, I gave a short presentation that was captured on video here at RPTS, and we're going to put that on our website as well. So if you want to just hear CJ lecture a little bit on this topic, you can go there and enjoy that as well. Thank you again for listening to 3GT.
This episode of 3GT is brought to you by Whip and Stock Publishers, who has recently published C.J. Williams' book, The Shadow of Christ in Job. For your chance to win one of three copies, head on over to gentlereformation.com and leave a comment under the post for this episode. Again, thanks to our sponsor, Whip and Stock Publishers.